We believe that alcoholism is a disease and that Alcoholics Anonymous is one solution to that disease. I'm here to bring you the voices of its members. Everyone that comes on the show, including myself, is an active member and has found recovery in the rooms of AA. As you listen, please take what works for you and leave the rest.
Hi, my name is Melanie and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is January 24th, 2011. I always like to know some of these things when I hear other people share. So I also say that I am 36 years old. So I got sober when I was about 26, which is wild. It's been a while. I have a sponsor and she has a sponsor and I have sponsees right now. And I just sort of say that to say that I'm grounded in this work and I'm grounded in AA because it has given me my life, a life. The cliche of beyond my wildest dreams, but it's the life I always wish I always wanted to have. And the work is not really work because it's a joy to do, because it keeps me present in the moment, connected to a higher power, which basically just helps me roll with the punches and not get in my way. This is not how I used to be. This is a different way of life than what it was like for me growing up. What it was like, what happened, and what it was like now, and what it's like now. So what it was like is my life was really sort of chaotic. I grew up in a house with two parents who loved me and took care of me and did the very best that they could. But they grew up with alcoholism in their family. And as I read and learned about this disease is that it is both genetic from a disease standpoint, but it's also, you know, when we are sick, we affect those around. When alcoholics are sick, they affect those around us, those who don't have a physical reaction to alcohol, the same way that I do, the same way that most alcoholics do. And what that looked like, my parents, they just tried the very best that they could. And I will say that their best was better than their parents' best. And I've come to a very, a better understanding about that. But it was still hard because my dad was an alcoholic and he drank a lot. And the way that his disease manifested was he would shut down. And what would happen is he would go into like the living room and he would drink and he wouldn't talk to us. Or if he did talk, if something did happen to him, if he got in a fight with my mom or anything like that, something upset him, he wouldn't talk to us for like 2 weeks at a time. And so what that forced me to do was to, the way that I adapted to it was to become a perfectionist, was because if my dad wasn't talking to us or if something wasn't happening like that, then I just learned to not be a problem. And the way that I'll just talk about like, I didn't start drinking until I was about 17, 18 years old. It was actually the night before my high school graduation. But I always say that like, I could have used a drink and I used other things to help me sort of let go of control, because as a perfectionist, and I'm also like a double Virgo, if that makes a difference or whatever, but I was very controlling and I wanted everything to be perfect and I wanted everything to go a certain way. And I also wanted to be perceived in the best way possible, definitely like an egomaniac. And so because I couldn't let go and I didn't know how to let go, and I wanted everything to be a certain way, I also had to be the very, very best. And so the way that that manifested was president of the student council, class president, captain of the soccer team. I was in a traveling soccer team, Olympic development program. I was a babysitter. I had to make sure all the parents liked me. And I had to make sure, like, and so if I drank, it could have, if I would have drank and got caught, I would have been kicked off the soccer team, or people would have talked about me and gossiped about me. And I cared so much what I thought other people thought of me that I couldn't have anything risk my quote unquote reputation. But the thing is that I had so much anxiety now that I'm looking back on it through a lot of work. It's like, I just had so much anxiety about being a teenager, and I am biracial. My dad is Chinese and my mom is white, but I grew up in a predominantly white town. And so I looked different. I looked like exotic. Everyone told me how different I looked. Where are you from? So already that, like, I'm different in that way. I'm different because my dad wasn't a lawyer or a doctor or a good businessman. He worked in like the restaurant industry. So already, like, I'm different in that way. I'm different because I wasn't tall and skinny and blonde like my friends. I was like a muscular athletic person, and that set me off. Like, I was just different. I was always like overweight, even though like I was exercising a certain period of time. So like, I always felt like I never, ever fit in. And the way that my control, like the way that I let go of control if I couldn't drink, was I actually picked up food. I used food a lot. I just binged, and I would always hold myself to this very strict dieting regimen of like only consuming like a certain number of calories a day. And then if I messed it up, then I would beat myself up over it. And then I would binge eat, and then it would start this cycle of then like, oh, see, I can't hold it to the thing, my expectations, and I can't do that. So I'm a terrible person. And then I would start that cycle. And it's a cycle that I became very familiar with, especially with drinking, because I would always, when I then picked up drinking and when I started drinking, I would always like have these plans of like, okay, only drink like 3 glasses of wine. And like this time you're not going to black out. This time you're going to remember where you live. This time you're going to do this. Like, I would always try to manipulate these things. And then inevitably I would always fail. And then it would bring me down back through the cycle of, I am a terrible person. I'm a piece of shit. I don't deserve to be here. And which would then fuel me to then pick up drinking and eating again. And it was just this vicious cycle. And what happened when I first drank was, it's funny, every time I talk about it, I just always say like, I take a deep breath because I can feel it. Like, I feel the relief that first drink gave me. And it wasn't like a delicious drink. It was like raspberry Smirnoff mixed with Crystal Light raspberry ice. And it's a very distinct taste and flavor. And it was way too strong, and it was so gross, but it was also just everything that I had ever wanted. It was finally like I could let go. I could forget about what my friend's parents thought of me. I could forget about what the teachers thought. I could forget about what my boyfriend thought. I didn't have to care about my parents fighting, and I didn't have to like think about like how different I was. It just went away, and it felt so good. And it was like, I could not get enough. And it was pretty indicative of the way that my drinking continued to be for the next so many years. Was like, the only way that I could stop was by blacking out or passing out. That was pretty much it. Like, and if I did try to control the drinking. Like if I tried to like not black out or pass out, I was miserable. And I was thinking about it the whole time. It was just like me sitting at dinner with people being like, why aren't they drinking this much? Okay. Like, all right, look at, okay. You know, you're having that glass of wine and why aren't you drinking fast enough? Like, what, you know, like trying to like egg people on so that we could just drink more. Or like, if I wasn't, you know, only having two glasses of wine because I was with my mom, I would then be mad at her for like holding me back. And you know, my drinking progressed. I always like the progression, what that looked like for me was being able to, go out, but still be able to like, maybe I would like black out or pass out, but I would still be able to like come home, take my contacts out, wash my face, brush my teeth, get into my pajamas and get into bed. That's how it started because it was like, I don't know, like once a week or every once in a while. And then it progressed to the point where like, okay, I would make it outside of my apartment. I couldn't actually get in the door. But I would make it to my apartment and then I would be, then the progress to me not knowing, where I lived and, not knowing how to get home. And it just was, I put myself in a lot of dangerous positions. It is a miracle that I am alive. And I went to school in Boston and then I moved to New York after I graduated. And it really is a miracle that I somehow made it through drinking and blacking out in New York and coming out relatively unscathed. I will say that, you know, it's not like my like physically sort of unscathed, but some of the things that happened, were really hard. And it's taken a while for me to like, to forgive myself for some of the things that I did and what happened. You know, I slept with a lot of different people. I just didn't care what happened to my body. I was assaulted. I got pregnant from a one-night stand and I had to get an abortion, which I think also just set off a whole other set of, this is why I'm messed up. This is why I don't deserve anything. So I'm just going to drink because this is what I do. And this is how I am. And I would like go to parties with guys that I just met and it was really shady. And then I eventually also picked up, I picked up drugs like cocaine and, I had all these rules for myself, right? If I had a bunch of rules, like I never got a fake ID when before I was 21, because that would mean that I could get in trouble and I had a problem. And the same way that I never had a dealer, because if I had a dealer, then I had a problem. You know, and it was just like, all right. I mean, I just manipulated my way to finding alcohol before I turned 21. And I just hung out with a lot of people who had their own dealers. But like, again, I had these like rules set up. Like if I break these rules, that means that I have a problem. I don't have a problem. So, and what was great about the stimulants, which is they talk about in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous too, is like, if people say like, oh, there's no talk of that. It's like, no, Bill also talks about stimulants a lot. And he used them to help balance out his drinking. And it did help me too. It helped me to not black out. It helped me to stay awake and to like sort of be aware of my surroundings and to just like help me get through a lot of situations. And I would also use Adderall. And then I got, my doctor to prescribe me, I wanted him to give me Adderall, but he gave me Ritalin, which was very rude, but had the same effect. Just so that I could drink and use to, again, to just not feel, to just I knew I always was different. I felt different. Just like everyone is different, but I both had this terminal uniqueness where I just felt like I am more different than you. You have never felt this way. And it got to this point again, where the progression was where I wasn't able to get home. I couldn't remember where I lived. And there were a few circumstances, a few situations that really led me to finally coming to AA. And I tried AA once before, and how I got there was because I had developed these really, really in the summer and fall before I got sober. I had developed these really, really bad stomach aches. I was living off of a diet of dollar slices of pizza and popcorn because I thought it was because I was being financially like stable, being like, oh, see, look at all this money that I'm saving by only eating pizza and having popcorn for dinner and wine. But really, it was because I was just basically broke from not just buying alcohol and from like buying wine and like going out, but because when I was drunk, I would just spend so much money. And I also lost so many cell phones that my insurance like actually had to like drop me. So I was like using like a flip phone because that was like $50 to replace. But again, this is like a lot of money going towards like just money that I wasted. I lost like passport and really nice shoes. I left them in the back of taxis. And then it would also lead to me, because I would then do these things at night, it would lead to me like shame eating the next day because I felt so terrible about what had happened. And I was so embarrassed that I would then order like Eggs Benedict and waffles and like French fries the next day, to help soak up the shame. And I would then like watch reruns of Law and Order SVU. So anyway, all that to say is my diet was not super. I was really stressed. I was at work and I had these really bad stomach problems. And on my birthday, I ended up actually having to go to the ER because I couldn't stand up because my stomach hurt so much. And I went there and they were like, okay, there's not really much we can do for you. Like, you might have an ulcer, but like, I don't know. It was like the ER. There wasn't really much that they could do for me. But they're like, if you want to, you can go to like a gastroenterologist and they can check it out. So I went to a gastroenterologist and he was like, all right, yeah, you know, you're really sore in all these areas. So we should do like an upper, like lower endoscopy. And then he asked me like a question that like every doctor asks or whatever. He was like, so how much would you say that you drink, like a day? And I was like trying to impress this doctor. And I was like, okay, if I say two drinks, which is like what you're supposed to do, that's really lame. But if I tell him I have like 8 to 10, that, which is what I usually drink, which is like a bottle and a half of wine, that's a problem. And I don't want to be like, and that, I don't have a problem, but like, that seems way too much. So I'm just going to tell him five. Five seems like a really, like she can hang. She seems like a good time. So I told him five drinks and he was like, that's too much. That is more than one should be drinking. I would really like for you to try to cut back. That's probably contributing to some of your stomach pain. And before we have this procedure, I need you to not try to drink for like 2 weeks before the procedure. I was like, excuse me, doctor, I have a wedding this weekend. He was like, I don't care if you have a wedding. He's like, don't drink. But like, if you tell that to someone, an alcoholic, like, how do you do that? How do you go to a wedding and not drink? That's just not how life works. And but he was just like, you need to not drink because it's really important. And I was like, okay, fine. But of course I go to this wedding and I'm like, okay, so not drinking to me at that time was just drinking less, which meant I would have a glass of wine and then three glasses of water in between each glass of wine, because I didn't know that you could even go to a large event like that and not drink. Well, of course, as it always happens, because as what I learned when I came into AA, I have this physical allergy to alcohol, which means when I put alcohol into my system, it sets off this mental obsession, which means that I just need to drink more. And there is not enough water in between me and that next drink that will stop me. It could be three, it could be a gallon, three glasses, a gallon, whatever. Like I needed to drink. And of course it went from, you know, one to three to one to two to like just wine, tequila. And the next thing I know, I'm in the back of a black car driving around Queens and Brooklyn. I don't remember this, but again, like I don't remember where I live at this point. He drives me around and he drops me back off in front of the venue with a $300 bill. And this is like, this dates me. This is right. This is before Uber. So like he actually held my wallet like ransom until like I could pay it. But like he left and he like gave his number to my friend, and my friend was like somehow outside smoking. And he was like, I don't know where she lives. I guess I'll take her home. And so he took me home to his apartment and I woke up there and he was like with only my cell phone and my wallet was the guy had it. And I woke up in the apartment and he was like, yeah, you need to get your shit together. And I was like, and this is a guy that partied as hard as I did. We went out together all the time and he was more of a mess than me. And he's telling me I need to get my shit together. And I was so embarrassed. I was so ashamed. And he gave me like enough money to just get the subway home. And I ended up getting my wallet back. I actually had to like write a check for like $300 and something, which was more money than I had at the time. And it was just so, I was so embarrassed. And I had actually watched an episode in my hungover state. I watched an episode of Law & Order SVU. And this was an episode where a guy had 7 years sober. He had like a 7 year AA check. And in a blackout, he had killed someone on accident. And that was one of the like sort of higher power moments of just me showing me like, oh my God, my life is unmanageable because I could do something like that in a blackout. That could happen to me. Because I don't know what happened. I couldn't remember being in this car. I couldn't remember. And it scared me. And I remember I called my mom and I was like, okay, I'm going to try going to my AA meeting. And so I went to one on Monday. This place called French Church in New York. And there was just, oh my God, everyone was just so happy. They were talking, but I came in late, I left early. I didn't raise my hand. It was just like so overwhelming. They said that if you had taken a drug in like the last 24 hours, not to share. And I didn't know what that meant. And so I was just like, okay, cause I had like taken antidepressants and I think I used Ritalin at work and I was like, I don't know. And so I left and I didn't say hi to anyone, didn't raise my hand again. And I tried another meeting the next day and I was just like, you know what? This isn't for me. I don't really have that big of a problem. It's fine. You know, like I'm just going to drink beer and wine because I had this delusion. I have this like idea that like, no, like I have control over this. Like I have the willpower to not get in that situation again. Well, that was in November of 2010. And I had started a new job in January. And between that time, I've actually gone to a few parties where I didn't drink a lot. I even said no to parties where I knew there were going to be drugs. And so again, I felt confident. I was like, that was a one time, like, that was a thing. And that's not going to happen again. I've got this. I don't have a problem. Like, it's going to be fine. I'm just going to drink wine. And I even remember calling my mom and just being like, Mom, yeah, I think it's okay because I really want to have champagne at my wedding one day. And I was extremely single, but I lived in this future moment where I was going to be married I was going to get married and I was going to have to drink champagne because in my mind, I had not even like imagination, but like any idea that you could go to these events and not drink. Just, I didn't know how you did any of it. I didn't know how you would go to hang out with your family, how you would go on a date, how you would go to a work event, how you would spend a Thursday night. Like, how do you do anything without drinking? And so I told my mom this and she was like, she's a little enabler. And she was like, of course, you know, just drink wine. It's the vodka and the tequila that's the problem. And so I, you know, I did that. And then I started a new job and they had a work event and they had a work party. And I don't know, there was a cute guy at the bar. And he had the audacity to have a girlfriend and not look at me. And I was so mad at him because I was so like, even though I thought I was a piece of shit, I also thought I was like the hottest shit. Like I thought that like everyone should be looking at me and everyone should fall in love with me. But then like the second that they didn't, I was like, well, see, you're proving my point. And so then I just got drunk and I blacked out and, again, not my intention because this is in front of all brand new coworkers, who I had never met before and I needed to impress them. And they had given me a laptop, which I had brought because I was going to bring it home to do work. And, I just left the bar. I left the bar in a tank top and, this was in the middle of January. And this has been retold to me. I got in a taxi, but again, I forgot where I live. And I also left my wallet at the bar. And so he dropped me off in front of a police station where two off-duty cops found me because I was apparently trying to break into cars because it was the middle of January and it was cold out. And in that state that I was in, it made sense to break into cars because it was warmer. For some reason, these cops didn't throw me in the drunk tank, but instead they called my mom, who is in Wisconsin, which is where I grew up. And instead of, she told them to call my family friends who live in Manhattan. They somehow got a hold of them and their family friends in the person, they're very close to me and I call them my grandparents. So they call them and they're like, take her to Roosevelt Hospital, which is now called Mount Sinai. Take her there. We'll meet you there. And they're like, okay, but just so you know, we have to handcuff her because she's trying to punch us. And they're like, oh my gosh. Okay. So they take me to the hospital. I guess I'm handcuffed to a gurney because I'm also trying to like punch the nurses and I sleep it off. My grandparents come back and get me at 6 a.m. and I wake up in their apartment, not knowing how I got there in my grandmother's nightgown. And it was, there's a phrase in the book that people say, incomprehensible demoralization. And that is a phrase that I hold tight because that is exactly what it felt like. It wasn't even humiliation. It was just, I was like, I knew this was it. This was it. I was going to die. Like it wasn't even just embarrassment of letting them down. It was all of that. It was all of the embarrassment, the shame, the humiliation, the fear is just so, it's captured in that incomprehensible demoralization. And they, again, that because their family rent, their son was in AA, had been sober for about 7 years, and they got him on the phone and they put like the phone to my ear and he was just like, hey, Mal, you know, you don't have, try not to drink this weekend and meet me for coffee on Monday. And I was like, okay, I have work. I can meet you at like noon. He was like, that's perfect. So I met him and I don't even remember the 2 days in between. I don't know if I drank. I don't know. I honestly can't remember what happened, but I know that that Monday I met him for coffee, and then he took me to a meeting at NYU in New York, which is near where I worked at the time. And it felt, it was almost like that same, the same relief that I felt when I had that raspberry Smirnoff and raspberry ice. It was the feeling that I could breathe. And that, you know, it was going to, somehow it was going to be okay. But like, I was still very, I was not sure how it was all going to work out. And I left because I had to go back to work, but I came back the next day. I don't know why, but I did. And I heard this woman share, and she had talked about, I don't remember, I think it was, she had had a miscarriage and she didn't drink, and how in her first year of sobriety, or first thing, she had broken a leg and she didn't drink through that. And I was like, how do you do that? How do you get through life and how you get through these things and not want to numb yourself? And she also just seemed happy despite going through all of that. And I don't, it was like the friend who was there at the meeting with me, and he's like, he knew that I was like tuned into her. And so he like found a way to like introduce us. And it was at the moment my life really changed. You know, AA wasn't the first thing I wanted to do, but it was, I was about to, if I didn't do something different, I was going to lose my job. And I was going to have to move back to Wisconsin. And I just didn't know what was going to happen. And I also knew that I was probably going to die. And I needed to do something different. So I did. And so she gave me her number, and I called her, you know, the next day, because she was like, and call me. And I was like, what? Okay. You told me to call you. I'm going to call you. And the next day I had like these plans to meet people after work for dinner. And my mom was so worried about me. She was calling me all the time. And I was so mad at my mom for calling me. So I was like, how dare you? And, you know, even though I was like picked up from cops, like literally like less than a week before, but I was still like so mad at my mom. And, you know, my sponsor was like very gentle, just being like, okay, you know, book at me before this. She's like, you don't have to go to that event. You don't have to. And I was like, I have to go. I have to go. She's like, okay, well, if you have to go, then, you know, these are the things to do. Like, go to a meeting before or after, call me, check in, bookend this event. And, you know, if you can, leave early. And I was like, okay, you know, like very tactical ways to live my life, to live life. And, I made it through that one thing. And I called her the next day. She was like, maybe at this meeting, blah, blah, blah. And we got coffee, and she was like, all right. So I'm like, will you be my sponsor and all this work? She was like, of course I will. But if we're going to work together, these are the things that you're going to have to do. This is what I did when I got sober. This is what worked for me. And this is what I suggest that you do. And what she said was, I mean, we need you to call me every day. She's like, not because I'm dying to hear from you, but because you need to learn how to pick up the phone and ask for help. And to start developing that muscle of asking for help and reaching out and using that instead of drinking. I'm going to need you, you should go to 90 meetings in 90 days. And she's like, and I recommend you go to a lot of different ones. Find out what works for you in terms of a time and a convenience, what people you like, what makes you want to go back. And because I got sober in New York, like I was very lucky that there were hundreds of meetings to choose from, but it was amazing because I did. I ended up finding, and she's like, I want you to find a home group. And, you know, after that, find a group that you want to go to consistently and then get a commitment there. And so I did. I luckily my office moved, and I ended up being like three blocks away from this meeting in New York called Midnight that met all the time. So I would go after work. It was like a meeting at 6:30. I would leave work at 6:15. I would go to like the bodega and get a packet of peanut butter M&Ms and a seltzer. And I would go and I would sit there. And that's where I went out sober for my first 2 years. And as soon as I was able to, I got a commitment. Before then, I was just like helping sweep up or helping put the chairs away. But then as soon as I got 90 days, I think I could start chairing meetings, because it helped keep me accountable and it helped me develop the self-esteem that I so, so needed, because all of a sudden, slowly over time, I got this confidence of like, okay, not only can I like stay sober, but like I'm showing up places. Like, and I'm showing up consistently because AA starts on time. Like, if there's one thing that's always consistent, it's like the meeting will always start when we're supposed to start it. And I needed to learn how to show up. And I started to like develop this, like to become an adult. And the other thing that she wanted us to do was to meet once a week, so that we could read together, read and go through the 12 steps as they're outlined in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And what we did was we would just read. We would read together. And as a step came up, we would do it. And it was really helpful to have someone read it with me, not only because I was a completely mocus, like mind out of focus person in my first year, like I could barely function, but because the book is really, in my experience, and I've taken a lot of people through it, it was written in the 30s by a white dude. So it's like, there's some words in there. There's like whoopee parties. What does that mean? What, like when they talk about jitters, which is like basically anxiety now, but like there were just all these different terms and I needed someone to help translate it for me. And so that's what she was. She was basically a translator. She helped me like, you know, I just underlined like where I highlighted and where I identified. And there were so many parts in that book, especially when we got to the pages right before the third step prayer, where it talks about the control, talking about the actor trying to run the whole show. If everyone and everyone did exactly what I wanted, everything would be great. You know, I'm either going to manipulate, you know, be really nice to you so you do what I want, or I'm going to be really withholding for you to do what I want. But I will try to do all these things so that things would go the way that I wanted. And that was part of this letting go of the fact that I don't have control. I don't have control over the fact that my parents got divorced, and they didn't get divorced the way that I wanted them to be. You know, they didn't have an amicable divorce. It was actually very contentious and very difficult, but I couldn't control that. And I learned that, like, I can't control how I think other people think about me. I don't have control over a lot of things, but what I do have control over is to just trust that I'm going to be taken care of, and that the third step of my experience will benefit others. The things that have been difficult, some of the traumas and these difficult things can benefit others. And so it's not like any experience that I have is pointless or useless. It is actually a tool. And it started slowly over this time of reading with my sponsor and doing these steps. The way that I thought shifted. So they call that like a spiritual experience. It's actually like in the appendix. I didn't have this like white light. Oh, okay. I believe in God. Everything's great. I love it. You know, like Bill has, and a few people have, which is like amazing for them. Mine was a very slow, and it continues to be slow over a period of time, of learning how to trust in something else, because I didn't know how, and I didn't know what that looked like. And what it started off as was me trusting that like other people had gone through similar things too and not drank, And at first that was going to a work event. I had to go to a work event when I had like maybe 50 days. And it's just going to be so much free wine and champagne. And I love free wine and champagne. Like I could do with like hard liquor, but like I love the bubbles. I love that like bougie feeling that I felt drinking it. And there was just going to be a lot of it there. And I shared about it in meetings and people would come up to me and be like, you know, I had to go through the same thing. I also worked in PR. This is what I did. And so I took their suggestions. And what that looked like was bookending it. So I called my sponsor before the event, during it, when I felt like really, when it was really hard, I texted her when I was in the bathroom, I texted other people. Other people checked in with me and then it was over. And I went home. And I was like, okay, all right. But like I needed to go through that one experience to then show that I could then get through more. The fact that like I had a wedding to go to like in September. And I was like, how do you go to a wedding? I'm gonna be so single. How do I do that? And it was like, okay. Well, you know, you have this other experience behind you and like, and then other people would share theirs. And I did the same thing. And it slowly became what they call in the book, like a working part of my mind of like putting new things into practice. And, you know, of doing the amends and like making, being able to go to a boss who had basically put fired me and like make amends for my behavior showing up hungover. And, you know, going into that scared as shit, you know, be like, what am I going to do? Okay. And like, just like, all right, you know, whatever happens, like I'm going to walk out of there. And even if she yells at me, tears me down, and even if this happens, I don't have to drink. I can go to a meeting. I have a meeting planned. Like I can do that. And I actually went to that and she was like, what? Oh, I don't even remember it that way. Oh my gosh. And so like, whatever. It's just so great to see you. You know, how are you doing? And oh my God, you're looking for a new job. Oh my gosh. Well, let me be a resource for you. Let me be a reference. And I was like, what? You know? And it was like, and walking out of that being like, that is not at all what I expected. And it was like, that's what life has continued to be. It's just like a series of like, that is not what I expected. And just showing like being humble, like the humility of just being like, I don't know everything. I really think I do. I think I have a very wild imagination. And, you know, and I'll just talk about like what sobriety's looked like for the last like 10 years. So it was like, all right, over that first year, I just really focused on sobriety. I went on like a few dates, but I definitely took the suggestion of like no dating in the first year to like an extreme, or no like hooking up. Because I also get very emotionally entangled and like I become very obsessed. Like my crushes were just very intense. So, but I did, I got sober my first year, and then the second year, I like sort of dabbled in dating, but like I really got used to like the emotional sobriety of like, okay, great, I can do it for a year, but like what now? What do I do now? And my sponsor actually had me do this practice of like things I want in an ideal person. And I had to write down all these traits, like, I don't know, like financial security, family relationships, like hobbies, all this stuff. And I had to put them in these like three categories of like, must 100% be present. It would be nice if, it like 100% must not be present. And it was really great to categorize it, you know, all these things. But what I realized is that like, if I wanted my partner to have financial security, I needed to have financial security. And so I spent the next year, like really working on getting over my fear of like looking at a budget. Like, what does that look like? How do I become financially secure? Like, how do I actually own a phone that isn't a flip phone? I worked in like social media and marketing, and I needed to like actually have an iPhone, and I couldn't afford it. So I had to like start saving money so that I could like get a phone, and learning how to like pay my rent on time, learning how to show up to work on time, like doing all these things so that like I could be, you know, instead of expecting this one person to come in with all these traits and like solve my problem, I needed to come to the table with what I wanted it in a partner. And so that's what I did over like the next 2 years, was like doing that and like learning and then going on a bunch of dates, with the idea of collecting, dating is collecting data. And so I would go on these dates not to like, to help me practice, first of all, like interacting and engaging with people, but to also learn what I wanted in a partner and what I liked in a partner, what was truly important to me. And when I started dating, my idea of like being an attractive person or whatever, what I thought was like, I needed to like sports. I needed to like ESPN. I needed to do all these things because that's what I thought guys wanted. And sure, there are some guys that do like that, but I realized I was doing that to make them happy, but it didn't make me happy. And so I was just like, oh, I don't have to do that anymore. Okay, that's not important to me. And I realized, and it was like so great to realize that, like, it was not against like anyone that does. It was just like, oh, I was doing that to make others happy, but not myself. And that was a waste of like my time and energy. Time and energy that could be used doing so many other things, especially like being of service, like to AA meetings and to other recovering alcoholics. And I would go on these dates, and not only sports wasn't important to me, but it turns out what I found out, what I really love, is like television. Television's really important to me, watching all these different shows. So I went on a date with someone who was lovely, and we had like a really great connection, but he only liked watching like the news, Wheel of Fortune and Seinfeld. And I was like, that's great. I want to watch more things. And so it was like really great for me to like learn that. And it didn't make him a bad person. It didn't make me a bad person for not like us not connecting. It just made us different, and that was okay. And it was over a period of time where I also like, going into dating, had so many hangups. I had so many crushes where I would meet someone, especially in the rooms. I would like see someone across the room who was sharing their whole story, and I would be like, oh my gosh, he's amazing. And I would like have our life planned out and everything. And over this course of like dating period of like me being like, all right, I learned how to like trust myself and also get to a place where, you know, when I had written out my fourth step, my fear inventory, I was totally afraid that I was going to die alone and I was like going to be alone forever. And it got to this point where I was like, I'm never going to be alone. I will have AA. I will have my family. I will have this family of friends that I've learned, that I've grown, and I will be taken care of. And I got like really comfortable and like happy in that place. And of course, as that happens in my like fourth year of sobriety, while I was just like dating around and having a fun time, I met this guy, and then it was like I kind of like wrote him off as just being like, oh, whatever. And then we finally went on a date, and it was one of those things where I was like, this is going to be the last first date I ever go on. And it really was. And that was a whole other different challenge of my sobriety, because now I am being vulnerable for like, not like for really the first time of like, oh my gosh, this is someone that like I want to spend my life with. And like, I ended up being like really honest with him up front, just being like, and knowing that I was going to be taken care of. I remember I like even brought like a guy I prayed before this day. And I remember just being like, all right, you know, your words, my voice, like I'm going to be taken care of, but I just need to tell this guy my truth, and whatever works out, works out. And I go to him and I'm like, so here's my deal. Like, I want to have kids and I want to get married. And this is where life, you know, I'm going to turn 30 this year. I would like to have kids before I'm 35. And if you're not on that same page, that's totally fine. But this is just where I'm at. And he was like, yeah, no, that's where I'm at too. And it was like part of that fear of just being like, this is saying what I wanted and what I needed. And this is where I was, and not being afraid of that as opposed to letting it drag out. And, you know, it was hard because there were things that we had to get over a lot in our relationship. He traveled a lot. I had to learn how to trust him. I had learned how to trust myself, and like I threw myself into AA even harder. I got more sponsees, mostly so that, you know, it would distract me from texting him or like checking in or like getting in my own way. And it really like being of service and like honestly taking the sponsee through the third step, like kept me in the third step, kept me there. So like all of the things that I did with my sponsees always somehow mirrored back to where I was in my life of like learning how to let go, learning how to rewrite out resentments and fears, of learning how to like turn it over, of like letting go of my defects of character. Like everything sort of mimicked each other. And eventually, you know, we got engaged. And you know what? I didn't like the engagement ring. And it was like, how do you stay sober through that? And I had to like really talk, like, is this important to me? Is this something that I need to speak up for? How do I say this in a way that is loving and kind? And how do I do this? And like, and I was able to do it. And like with the help of like my sponsor and like the people in the program, and just being like, being able to have these tough conversations and not break up over it, but how to be like loving and kind. And, you know, we got married, and like two days after we got married, we got kicked out of our apartment because of landlord shenanigans. And then we were going on our honeymoon. Like we all, like all this life change happened in like less than a month, and I stayed sober through it all. And the beautiful thing is that in 2018, I actually, we had our first child, our son, and he was born in the same hospital where I detoxed in 2011, like two floors away. And, it was like a 100% full circle moment of, wow, life is truly, truly insane. And that birth was hard. It's not what I expected. But I got this amazing kid, and he is truly like keeping me in the steps, and then like making all of the things that the parenting books say about like how to show up and be a parent. It's essentially basically like being sober. It's like you need to heal your past traumas so that you can be able to show up for your kids. So when they're yelling, it doesn't set off a traumatic response in you. And I'm like, oh my God, that's exactly what I do in my test. I was like, how do I heal that? How do I show up? And, you know, they're like, if your toddler is screaming, you know, check to see if they're hungry, angry, lonely, or tired, which is exactly what I did in my first year sober and what I continue to do today. Like yesterday, I was going for a drive. We were going for a drive with my husband, and he said something, and I was like, my immediate reaction was like, God, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. But I didn't say it out loud, but I was like, oh, right. I'm hungry. I'm also 7 months pregnant and I'm hungry. So, I'm going to just hold that thought until I eat something, and then we'll see if that comes back again later. And of course it didn't, but like, that's the things that I've learned in AA have helped me in my life. And you know, we moved to San Francisco. That's where I am now, right before the pandemic. And I haven't really found a home group here. I've tried, and then I've found one through Zoom. But it allowed me to reconnect with all my old home groups from New York, which has been an amazing connection back. I've actually gotten two new sponsees that I've never met in real life, which is really weird to like go through this program in a different way than what I ever knew. I've never done a fourth step over the phone. All my fourth steps have been in my apartment or in a coffee shop or like in a park somewhere, and we did it over the phone, and it was still beautiful and as meaningful as it could be in person. You know, it was just the essence of showing up for another person and listening to their experience and just telling them that they're not alone. And she's changed my life. She's shown me what it's like to be sober in a pandemic, but the same essence is the same. It's how to be honest, open-minded, and willing. That's really what it is. And if she can be all those things, I can be all those things, and I need to be those things to show her. That's how this works. And the reason we met is because she heard a podcast, and because she was she lives out where there aren't a lot of meetings. And she reached out to them and they told her about a few meetings to go to, and they all happened to be all of my old home groups. And so that's how we ended up meeting. And it's just the miracles of this program continue to astound me when I show up. And as I mentioned, like before, it's work, but it's like, it's the work that to me brings me fulfillment. It brings me that same sense of relief and deep breath that I got when I had my first drink and all those other drinks of, I no longer, it's not that I don't feel like I don't fit in, because there are a lot of times when a lot of this happens, you know, where I feel like I'm different. But what I have now is the structure in place in my life to be able to reflect on it and to say like, okay, if this is something that's been bothering me for a few days, why don't I write it out? Why don't I do some work on it, take some action? And it helps find me relief. You know, I write it out and then I talk to my sponsor, or I talk to my therapist, or I talk to a friend. And, you know, this way of life is a completely different. I've had a spiritual like upheaval. It's like an emotional personality change where like the things that are a part of me are still the same. I still love watching television, and I still love like, you know, Jane Austen movies, and I still love all these things, but I approach life differently. I am no longer a victim of like thinking what people can give me. It's more of how can I show up for others? And that is a shift. When I don't do this work, I can go back to that same place of feeling those ways, of feeling like I am spiritually corrupt and not like it's the bedevilments of feeling fear, resentment, all of that. And I have felt that way. And it's amazing is that when I'm sober is I can recognize it and then I can see it. And instead of getting mad at myself, I can say like, okay, what are the steps that I need to do to move through it? And it's just such a better way of living. And it's really amazing. And I think my higher power, whatever it is, it can be, sometimes it's my great grandmother, sometimes it's witches, sometimes, you know, I would go to like an apothecary. I get hippy dippy with it because it can be, it's fluid, and I like that about it. It doesn't have to be the Catholic God I grew up with. It can be whatever I want. It can be the trees. We live near the ocean, and so I see the waves, and I think I can't control that. And that to me is what my higher power is. And so I will wrap it up with just saying I'm grateful to be alive. I'm grateful to people who are listening and people who are doing service to continue to bring this message in a whole bunch of different ways, because this program is still relatively new. It's old, but it's new, and I'm excited to see what happens next. So with that, I will close and say thank you.
Thank you. You know, you wrap up there with this program is old, but this program is new. And that reminds me of the part of your story where you were talking about sponsoring people that you've never met and doing a fourth step in person. And just 2 years ago, you couldn't have a sponsor out of state. If your sponsor moved out of state, you had to find a new sponsor. That was the norm in the rooms. It was very taboo to have a sponsor that moved and not get a new one.
Yeah.
And today it just reminds me of being honest, open-minded, and willing. Like, we have to be open-minded, even if we've been doing it for, you know, 80 years a certain way, doesn't mean that that's going to continue to work that way. So the open-mindedness never ends, right?
No. And I think that's going to continue with some of the language in the book too. You know, it's like, if people are uncomfortable with it, I think that's okay. You know, it was written a long time. It was written almost 100 years ago. And I think, you know, there is a lot of work that's being done at the group level to investigate it. And I think that same willingness and open-mindedness of, first of all, like going through the book as it's written now and trying to understand the context of the time with that it's written, but also taking steps to making the literature more approachable for someone who doesn't know that context. So I always say that change is always, it's always happening and it's always possible. We just have to work at it, which sometimes I don't always want to do.
Okay. So I do have to hear about the engagement ring. So did you tell him you didn't like it and then got one you did like?
Oh my gosh. Well, it was a lot of me having a lot of expectations of me thinking that, like, you know, if I could do it over again, I would say like, hey, let's go look for an engagement ring together, or being somehow more abundantly explicit of being like, this is a thing that I will wear and why. The ring that he got is extremely, it's so well-meaning and it's extremely sentimental. Like he knows that I love like very like period pieces. And so he got a ring that was like from like the Georgian era. And it is beautiful, but it was also like, I had to take it off every time that I worked out or I washed my hands. And so it was also like impractical and it didn't really fit. And it just wasn't my thing. And so I don't even remember like totally what I said, but it was those family and saying like, hey, this isn't what I had talked about, like what I had imagined. And I love it. And it's actually, it had like an amethyst stone, which is again, not my style, but there is actually like a sober quality to it. It's like supposed to be a ring that protects you against sobriety or protects you for sobriety. So I could find meaning in it, but it wouldn't have been honest. And I needed to find a way of being honest with him in a way that was loving. And he took it really well. He was like, well, I mean, I want you to wear it and I want you to love it. So let's talk about it. So he did. And I ended up getting one that I love and I wear it every day.
Oh.
And I can wear it through all my workouts and it's great.
It's funny how the rooms, we make things such a big deal in our head. And our go-to action is to manipulate or lie, or how do I get out of this one? How do I fix this problem? And then it's like, oh, with honesty and kindness? I don't know how to do that. Can you walk me through that, please?
What is that? What does that look like?
And you're 7 months pregnant and you're the stupidest thing I ever heard. It's like that was hilarious. All right. So I have not heard the expression bookend before. I love that idea of bookending. And it reminded me a lot of the first travels I had to do in sobriety. And the first one was like a 3-night thing. And I loved your description of how like you just had to get that experience under your belt, you know, and you had to get that to be a working part of your mind. And that means a lot to me. And it could be applied to any part of our life now, right? We have all these firsts, not just in sobriety, but these firsts in life. You know, you're going to have 2 kids. If you think one changes your relationship, wait until the next one comes. Yeah. But I got to tell you, mine are 6 and 9 now, and it's so much easier because they have each other and they have so much fun with each other. And, you know, so it's a lot of fun. I'm excited for you.
Yeah. Like, I mean, everything is fear tinged. It's like, it's all that unknown, the unknowns of, you know, when you first get sober, of how to go on a date and how to do this. And now my unknowns are, how is my kid going to go to preschool and how is he going to deal with a sibling? You know, it's like the unknowns will never stop coming. And so it's like, all right, well, if I can, and it's just a good reminder. It's like, all right, if I can go to that work party and not drink, then I can get through my kid going to preschool the first day. Or like get through them taking their first bath together or something, you know? But it's hard. It's hard to remember that. But that's why we go to these meetings and we talk to each other so that we can remember it. Yes.
And you're right. You know, meetings do start on time. We're like no joke about that. I mean, I've been to meetings all over and it's true. It's like, wow, we really are kind of up ass about, okay, come on, 7:30. We're starting. Yep. Stop talking.
Yeah.
Which I appreciate. but I don't appreciate them ending like, okay, you know, it's 8:30, time to stop talking. You know, I don't appreciate those. They're not often, but okay. And okay, so there's so many funny things. I didn't realize how funny you were. So the ER doc, and you're like, five a day. Oh, yeah. And would you say she can hang? She seems like a good time.
Yeah.
You thought he'd say, was he cute?
No, he was like in his 40s and married, and I was like in my 20s. Like, it's not like I even like thought like I would get a date out of it. It was just like, I just need to show this doctor that I'm cool. Like, yeah, that's like my own obsession with, I need everyone to like me. So I'm going to try to read how they're acting and tell them what I think I want them to hear. And I read that room totally wrong.
Apparently.
Yeah.
Imagine what he would have said if you told him how many you actually did drink. Mm. He might have locked you up.
I think I would have. I probably had to go to rehab and not, getting a scope.
I have two more questions. And one, I don't know if you're ready to talk about it, but you had mentioned like eating being an issue and using that with control, calorie counting, perhaps some eating disorder going on there. How does that present itself in your life today? Are you part of OA, or do you use Alcoholics Anonymous, or is that issue not present?
So I actually had to have like my own little spiritual bottom with it. Miraculously, part of it did not go away, but a lot of it subsided. I used to do a lot of shame eating. Like, I would get a box or like a bag of mint Milanos and eat them on the way home before my roommates could see them. And then once I got sober, I stopped doing a lot of the hiding. And I stopped needing to shame eat, because I no longer was doing things that made me feel ashamed. Mm. Funny how that works out.
Right.
But I had a lot of body image stuff that I had to really work through. It was really hard. I mean, I've only sort of come around to it. It was actually after I had my first kid, and I had gained a lot of weight. I had gained a lot of weight, which is like totally normal to do. But it was something that I was so obsessed over. And I remember I was trying to lose the weight, and I had a C-section, and I was still trying to walk like all the time to try to lose this weight. And I walked so much that I actually sprained my ankle. And a therapist, I was seeing a postpartum therapist, and she was like, well, what you need to do is you need to wear your kid. You know, instead of using a stroller, you should wear him. And, you know, because that's more weight for you. And I was like, and that woke me up to realize that's not what I need to hear. What I need to hear is that my body it sounds like a cliche, but like, it is beautiful no matter what. Like, it made this miracle of a child and kept me alive. Like, how do I be grateful for it? And it helped shift this idea that I have of my body being whatever size I needed it to be, but just that accept that it is what it is. And I no longer worked out, and I no longer work out with this idea of like trying to burn calories, but like how I can be strong. And I shifted this, like, my workout process, because I do love, I've always been an athletically driven person. And instead of like trying to achieve, like getting personal records and being faster or whatever, I'm just being strong and like feeling myself in my body. And it feels like it's been a whole other like experience where like I no longer count calories. I no longer obsess about what I eat. Like, I can eat a popsicle or have ice cream and not hate myself. It's like, that to me is also like another like gift of this program, is like really understanding like my value is not in what I look like or in what shape my body is. My value is determined by how I can be of service to others. And that's like, that's all God. Like, that's the same prayer that I used when I was trying to get through dating, of like, all right, you know, God, please remove my fear that like my boyfriend will break up with me, you know, I'm still valuable. I'm still loved. I'm still taken care of. You know, not in having my needs met, but in loving with no condition. And it's the same what I do with my body is like, my value is not determined by, you know, what I think this person thinks of my body. My body is a gift and I am valuable because I showed up for my sponsee and that, and I'm showing up for my family. So it's been like a real perspective shift that continues to take work. But it's much healthier than it was 10 years ago, for sure. Even 5 years ago.
I failed to say happy birthday. Happy birthday.
Oh, this is
10 years in January. That's awesome.
Yeah, it's wild.
That is a milestone for sure.
Yeah.
So final question for the alcoholic out there listening, perhaps still suffering, what message do you have?
I would say, give it a go. No, the honest, open, and willingness is hard. I don't really want to say, it's just like to try it, to try to set aside everything you think you know about what AA is, what the people are like, all of that. Set that aside and just try it. You know, find if there's a meeting that, you know, there's someone there that's being a real, this is like my aunt's such a mom, being a real ding-a-ling, try another meeting, you know, just keep trying, give it a go for like the whole like 90 days, which seems like a lot. But even just starting out small of just trying to find the people that you really like, there are so many different meetings out there. And I don't think Zoom is going to go away for a while. So if it's not even in your hometown, you know, maybe it's around the world, it's a different country. But what I would say is like, what helped me a lot was to not compare my like outsides, but was just to listen to see where I identified and just give it a try and, you know, see if your life gets better. And then as soon as you can, try to be of service. I think that was what really helped shift things for me too, was to no longer think about myself, but was to how to help other people.
For more information, read the first 164 pages of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous or visit keepcomingback.net.